Hello, and welcome to The Brief, a video podcast that looks at global news events and brings you perspective and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Clancy. As always, we do appreciate a like or a follow, and you can find links to all of our episodes at thebriefpodcast.org. Well, 2025 is offering a glimmer of hope, at least for Palestinians as well as Israelis, as a ceasefire in Gaza goes into effect. Those Israelis held hostage by Hamas begin to trickle out of hideouts where they've been held for more than 440 days and nights. Palestinians held prisoner for weeks, months, and in some cases even years by Israel, often without charge, trial, or conviction, are also going home. But the reality is that Israelis and Palestinians alike fear this is a deal that's on very shaky ground and may not be completed. Far-right Israeli ministers are already calling for a resumption of the onslaught that has, in their words, left Gaza uninhabitable for Palestinian families. Ahmed Shihab Eldin is a Palestinian journalist. He lives and works across the Middle East, and he's been following this crisis from the very start. His reports on the Middle East and Gaza have won many accolades from his peers. He joins us from Kuwait City. Hello, and welcome to The Brief, Ahmed. Can we begin here? And just give me your broad impressions of this ceasefire. Its hopes, its promises, but a lot of people still very nervous about this one and seeing it through.
Yeah, I think this week, Jim, the so-called ceasefire is really being revealed for what it truly is. A calculated pause that allows for a sinister agenda that is being cloaked in the language of peace. I think that serves both Netanyahu and Trump's political expediency, especially since it came just a day before the inauguration. I say this because in Gaza, where, as you know, every neighborhood has been reduced to rubble, we've seen families returning home, so to speak, but of course to no homes, but rather to ruins. And beneath those ruins remain the bodies of their loved ones that they're digging up with their hands. Civil defense forces in Gaza say at least 10,000 souls are still trapped under the weight of the rubble and the destruction unleashed in this genocide. So, you know, even hours ago, we saw in Rafah, Israel kill Palestinians in Gaza with artillery. Just yesterday, they targeted civilians in Tel el-Sultan, just west of Rafah, killing two Palestinians. Now, you know, for those of us watching Al Jazeera, for example, they keep saying a ceasefire that's largely holding. But these are all blatant violations of the ceasefire. I guess, Jim, for me, the ceasefire really masks something really sinister, which is a policy of imperial domination, a policy of eradication, of erasure, and the return of Trump, quite frankly, alongside Israel's far-right leadership. Even if we've seen one minister resign as a result of the ceasefire, there's been a lot of winking and signaling that they're now focused for the time being on the West Bank. They know that the mainstream media and the political establishment in Washington and in Europe are going to do what they've been doing for 15, 16 months. As we've seen all moral and legal norms be completely shattered, they're going to continue to absolve Israel of any accountability and to continue to grant Israel impunity. So to me, this signals, in short, a really frightful era where truth is being rejected, law is being dismantled, and believe it or not, genocide is being reframed as opportunity, as we saw President Trump respond to one of the reporters when asked about Gaza. I mean, his response was a green light for Israel to continue to ethnically cleanse both Gaza and the occupied West Bank.
Amid all of this, I mean, I think it's important to point out that the people of Gaza, and in their specific case, they have endured the most intense bombardment in modern history. I mean, an unbelievable amount of bombs were dropped that obliterated entire parts of cities.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the comparisons to World War II, to, I mean, those comparisons are fair, but it's hard to even fathom as we're watching, you know, Palestinians, as I said, try to return to their homes. They can't even recognize their neighborhoods. You know, these statistics, whether it was 85% or more recently, 92% of Gaza has been destroyed, or buildings in Gaza have been destroyed. We see UN officials who are there in this strip today saying they're driving for 10, 15, 20 minutes and they're not seeing a single building standing. You know, maybe there was no nuclear bomb dropped, but the tonnage that was dropped far exceeds Hiroshima and even what was dropped in Dresden. And well,
something,
you know,
on the order of 100,000 tons. And that was all mostly U.S. arms, mostly U.S. weapons.
Mostly U.S. weapons. And the ones that weren't U.S. weapons were German weapons, you know, those being the two biggest suppliers of arms. And I guess, you know, we haven't even stopped to think about the long lasting. And when I say we, I mean those of us who are paying attention still, because a lot of the world would be happy to just move on, right? And that speaks to, you know, why October 7th happened in the first place. It's been decades, as you know, as many people know, like yourself, veteran journalists who've been covering this. You know, Palestinians are dehumanized to an extent that we don't even deserve, you know, our suffering is we're vilified when we die, when whether we're alive, whether we endure suffering and ethnic cleansing. So, you know, when I see, you know, let's not even get into the asbestos and all the different chemical toxic waste that's going to be killing thousands, if not more, Palestinians in the weeks and months to come. You know, we've seen that after 9/11 in the U.S., and this is, you know, exponentially more catastrophic. And speaking of catastrophe, of course, the Palestinian word Nakba for what happened in 1948, you know, Israel's finance minister, Smotrich, called the ceasefire very openly a catastrophe. And the way Israeli media reports on this, whether Haaretz or others, is quite alarming compared to how the U.S. media and what's permissible in the U.S. media in terms of just factual reporting. I'm not talking about, you know, contextualizing commentary pieces or think pieces about all of this. I'm just saying the mere facts. I mean, Smotrich said the ceasefire was a catastrophe, and he openly is using the word cleansing when referring to what he thinks should continue to happen to Gaza, not to Hamas in Gaza, but to the Palestinian people in Gaza. So, you know, as I said at the top, like Netanyahu, who has long prioritized his political survival over the survival of the hostages, one of the stated objectives, you know, justifying or underlying this genocide. So the Israeli government's, you know, we've seen them repeatedly block ceasefire proposals. We've seen many of the ministers, you know, in Netanyahu's coalition admit that that is what they were deliberately doing. And we also saw the Biden administration turn a blind eye, not just to the carnage, but to all of the violations, the war crimes that were happening that Israeli soldiers were documenting themselves and publishing. And so every day without a deal was another day for Netanyahu to distract the Israeli public and the international community away from his own corruption scandals. And yeah, I mean, today, as you know, Jim, the Israeli regime announced a new military operation just after the so-called ceasefire went into effect in Gaza. It's called Iron Wall, and it's a very aggressive onslaught in Jenin, in the northern occupied West Bank. And that name itself, I don't know if you know or if your listeners know, the Iron Wall was actually, you know, a seminal piece of work of Vladimir Jabotinsky. He is one of the founding fathers of Zionism. It's also behind, you know, the ideological force behind Netanyahu's vision and his party. And I wrote it down here, actually. I just want to quote this to you, if I may. Jabotinsky wrote back then, "There can be no voluntary agreement between ourselves and the Palestine Arabs. The native population, civilized or uncivilized, have always stubbornly resisted the colonists." And I think That quote, written decades and decades and decades ago, acknowledges so many truths that the media and that Europe and the US and Israel's backers continue to try to deny, which is there has never been a ceasefire between the Palestinians and the Israelis that Israel has abided by. And this terminology of civilized and uncivilized, and his acknowledgement and admission that Palestinians will always stubbornly resist the colonists, like any group of people who are robbed of their freedom, their land, and their dignity, and who are enduring, whether we want to call it a genocide or ethnic cleansing, whatever you want to call it, Israel's goal is to erase Palestinians from Palestine, from 1948 Palestine, you know, cities that my grandparents are from, like Jaffa and Haifa. And I don't know who's going to stop them.
One of the stated goals of Netanyahu was, I am going to eliminate Hamas from Gaza. Well, you know, everybody told him, oh, please, you know, you're going to make it worse. As the hostages or the prisoners were being released in, from Gaza, you looked and you saw there was plenty of Hamas gunmen everywhere, and they looked fine. And it's just been an utter failure on that front, and it has really angered people like Smotrich and Ben-Gvir.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you talk about Ben-Gvir and Smotrich and their anger at those images. It's really fascinating to me when people try to use this boogeyman language. You know, in any media interview that I've done, and that's why I do so few of them in the U.S. these days, you know, they want to butt Hamas you using this sort of boogeyman, this idea that, well, you know, Hamas is classified as a terrorist organization by the U.S. So, like, how can you possibly defend their right to resist Israel or occupation or what have you? And, you know, the U.S. also used to classify the IRA, the ANC, as terrorist organizations before lauding them now as heroes. So history teaches us not only that oppressed people will always resist, but I think the reason, to your point, that Ben-Gvir was so kind of horrified by those images, or angered, let's say, is because it is undeniable that Israel failed at the stated objectives. So the question then becomes, as you said, you know, Israeli security officials, U.S. intelligence themselves, Jim, admit that Hamas fighters were only reduced a few thousand, from 25,000 to 19,000. And of course, as I am reminded by many people, for better or worse, they're going to be able to recruit all of those orphans, the tens of thousands of orphans who are, you know, teenage boys now living in this like completely destroyed strip of land, which is still occupied in my mind, still besieged. I mean, we know that oppression breeds defiance faster than defiance and resistance can be crushed. And Israel, I would argue, is counting on that because they need to justify these security barriers and these buffer zones and these policies of ethnic cleansing. I mean, the question becomes maybe, Jim, what did Israel gain? I mean, Hamas has certainly lost a lot, and the people of Palestine, the Palestinians, have lost a lot, but they also gained some things. I mean, there was going to be, as you know, and I know, and there's still a renewed effort for this, but as we're seeing from, you know, Trump's envoy, this idea of normalization between Saudi and Israel was really on the cards. And whether that was the main reason behind why Hamas, you know, why October 7th happened, it certainly seems much further away now than it was on October 6th, let's say. So Hamas hasn't been defeated. Netanyahu's real objective, one could argue, is, as we said, to turn Gaza into a parking lot, to make it uninhabitable, which is arguably something he may have, that wasn't his stated objective, but something he almost has achieved, as well as prolonging his political career. But, you know, Ben-Gvir himself is a convicted terrorist, and he is at the head, the helm of this far-right fascist government. So, you know, you have arrest warrants from the ICC for Netanyahu, and yet you have the U.S. sanctioning the ICC, and Trump obviously doubling down on that, because that happened, you know, Congress voted on that before Trump, you know, came into office. So I don't know. It's really worrisome. It's really troubling. And you know, this operation in the West Bank, as you and I are sitting here talking, my friends in occupied Palestine in the West Bank are enduring airstrikes, artillery shelling, the destruction of infrastructure. They're blockading checkpoints all throughout the West Bank, not just in Jenin. And what is the Israeli government's stated reason, according to Israeli media and Israeli press, to continue preserving the IDF's freedom of action throughout what they call Judea and Samaria? So they're saying that this operation in Jenin was meant to destroy and neutralize quote-unquote terrorist infrastructure. And I put that in quotes because, again, are these resistance fighters terrorists when they are living on their land that is occupied and they are living under I think people don't, the reason there's no space, and I appreciate joining you on this program, there's no space to discuss these things contextually in mainstream media is because if you do, you come to realize that as we hear over and over, Israel has a right to defend itself. That is actually, according to international law, not true on occupied land. If you are an occupier and it's an illegal occupation, according to the ruling of the ICJ, you know, they don't have a right to defend themselves. In fact, international law is clear that, you know, people who are occupied do have a right to resist, including armed resistance. And well, I'm not here to...
The Israeli strategy here, whether Gaza or the West Bank, is to send a very simple message. Resistance is futile. And that's what they want to get across. Ben-Gavir is talking about, you know, he has gone on with the make it uninhabitable. They're looking for the major ethnic cleansing. You know, you went back to your quote from history with Jabotnik, but that's where it started. That's what they've always believed. And believe me, I think everybody should be aware that, you know, this is what killed Yitzhak Rabin. I mean, they don't order it from Israelis or from Palestinians.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, look, Jim, you know as well as I do that when Palestinian, call it what you want, anger, resistance, defiance emerges anywhere in occupied Palestine, in any form, whether it's a kid throwing a stone, whether it's a protest that's violently suppressed by the Palestinian Authority themselves that are doing Israel's bidding in their security, you know, cooperation, if you want to call it, but what I call it, their complicity in the occupation. When Palestinian resistance emerges in response to the myriad of daily ongoing injustices and violence that is part of any military occupation, it's routinely framed immediately, as you're saying the Israelis are trying to do, as, what are the words, barbaric, inherently violent, irrational hatred against Jews, and, you know, or even terrorism, right? It's stripped of context, and worse, it's stripped of humanity. And, you know, as we know, the first step to genocide is to dehumanize the enemy. And so that's why what I find to be so sort of disappointing is today and yesterday, we see Israeli forces just hours ago, actually, have shut off electricity in the entire West Bank, in Jenin's refugee camp. I'm sorry, not the entire West Bank, in the entire Jenin refugee camp and many surrounding areas. Again, this is a repeat to your earlier point of what they did in Gaza. They're attacking the Jenin hospital. They're bulldozing the road that leads to the hospital. They're forcing the patients and the doctors in the hospital, in the Ibn Sina specialized hospital, to evacuate, even if they can't, because they can't, you know, move. Some of the patients obviously can't. You know, so currently the hospitals are trying to use fuel reserves and bring in more fuel to keep the power going for dialysis and all the emergencies. But again, Jim, you know, that's for many Palestinians, we have this thing in Arabic called sumud, like steadfastness, like, you know, just simply existing under these harrowing, insane conditions is a form of resistance. So is it a coincidence, I'd ask you, Jim, that the large-scale military campaign and aggression in the illegally, I should say, occupied West Bank comes just days after the calculated sort of Gaza ceasefire agreement that they were finally forced to accept, according to not me, but Israeli media reports that state that the reason they had to accept it was because of their failure, again, in achieving their main objective. So, you know, as you and I are sitting here, you know, talking, Israel is imposing mass closures on Palestinian towns, refugee camps, hospitals, cities. They're placing barriers and checkpoints between checkpoints, and they're closing all the main roads, making life, again, unlivable. And it's Israel's occupation forces that are working very closely in coordination with armed fascist settler militias, armed by Ben-Gvir, who are carrying out pogroms against indigenous Palestinians across the West Bank. This is happening in Masafer Yetta. This is happening under the protection of Israel's occupation forces. They're burning homes, cars, and businesses. And, you know, what's wild to me sometimes when I take a bit of distance, Jim, and I look on X, this is all being documented. Even as Israel has banned Al Jazeera, the only, you know,
Palestinian major authority has arrested Palestinian journalists for Al Jazeera. I mean, who do the Palestinians turn to? Look, it's going to take a lot of organization, hard work to rebuild Gaza, but who the hell is going to do it? Hamas seems to be in complete control. Israel wants UNRWA completely out. Who's going to do it?
And Trump has echoed those demands of Israel. And to your point, I'm glad you brought up sort of the Palestinian Authority arresting Al Jazeera journalists. I mean, the Palestinian Authority is also hunting down resistance fighters in Jenin, doing the work of the Israeli government. And that's why they've been so unpopular. The last time I was in Israel and Palestine in the West Bank reporting 4 or 5 years ago, every young teenager, anybody under 25 who I spoke to was so disillusioned with the Palestinian Authority. They do not feel represented by them. The Palestinian Authority, as you said, is not only arresting journalists, they're brutally beating and torturing anyone that they do arrest. And as you said, just today, they arrested, Al Jazeera says they arrested one of its journalists, Mohammed Al-Atrash, in order to prevent coverage. Imagine that. To prevent the documentation of Israel's military operations in Jenin. So
talking to journalists in Gaza, they say it was to prevent coverage, prevent documentation. They suffered a terrible toll where not only the journalists, but I think for the first time in my lifetime, journalist families were wiped out in this unfettered bombing campaign.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to understate how, I will use the word shameful and dangerous it is to see a broad lack of support and solidarity from journalists around the world, I would say particularly in the West, for the journalists who were trying to get the story out during these 15, 16 months of genocide. And the reason I say that is, as you know, Jim, you know, if Israel can get away with this, who's to say another state can't? And it becomes a very slippery slope. Like, I'm not a legal expert by any means, but if you listen to people like Francesca Albanese, who I know you've interviewed as well on this program, I mean, there's a precedent being set that spells disaster for anyone who really does believe not only in freedom and human rights and dignity for all, but really in the international system itself, especially now with Trump, you know, coming in and being so kind of bold in his willingness to sort of rewrite what it means to be a democracy. I mean, hours after his swearing in, as you know, the West Bank was put on lockdown. And, you know, Netanyahu said, I think last week, that Trump and Biden both gave him full backing to return to fighting in Gaza if Israel concludes that the negotiations on the second phase are going nowhere. So, you know, when you hear Smotrich, who's essentially been serving as the de facto governor of the West Bank, say that the operation in Jenin was started as part of a new goal for the war, you know, changing the perception of security in the West Bank. You know, and as you said, you know, he's vowed that his party will leave the government if the second phase of the deal goes ahead as planned. So to your question of who's going to rebuild Gaza, what use is it to rebuild Gaza? Is it feasible, I would ask, to rebuild Gaza so long as there's no accountability for those who destroyed Gaza?
In all of this, the Palestinians are left wanting somebody to represent them. And, you know, you look at Mustafa Barghouti and the National Initiative, 20% support in the elections 20 years ago, and really there hasn't been another test of all of that. Do you think that Palestinians, his is a nonviolent, but, you know, a movement with civil disobedience being an important component in all of that, but nonviolent, as he always stresses, this is what, you know, governments say they would like to see from the Palestinians. What are the Palestinians thinking today, do you think?
Oh, I don't know if I can even speak on behalf of Palestinians. One thing I think they're thinking is exactly what you're asking, which is who is going to save us from this hell in which we have endured and we have tried to remain, you know, hopeful and optimistic against all the odds. And, you know, you saw Qatar and Egypt and several others advocating for Israel to release Mustafa Barghouti. Marwan. And the reason that, of course, they're not, I would bet my bottom dollar that they're not going to ever release him, because...
Well, he's the leadership figure that everybody thinks of when they asked who could bring Palestinians together under a big tent and move forward and perhaps satisfy. He's a, you know, he speaks Hebrew now, and it would be a, you know, he could be a very forceful individual, which is why I don't think they're going to let him out.
No, I agree with you. I mean, he's often referred to as the Palestinian Nelson Mandela, whether that's true or not. He's also been inside prison able to unify prisoners, but also different Palestinians with different persuasions and religious beliefs, as well as political beliefs. And we also know he was brutally, repeatedly attacked and tortured by Israeli prison guards and left with multiple injuries. And so I think, you know, It is really demoralizing to me to see the way that after 16 months in the U.S. and Israel, the two powers that have been guilty or responsible for this genocide, you're seeing not only a rewriting of history, Jim, but the Israeli Knesset, as you know, is doing everything they can in addition to not releasing someone like Marwan Barghouti. But they release Palestinian prisoners or hostages as part of this deal. And then they go in the West Bank and they arrest. So they release 90 and then they arrest 60. And we've seen this time and time again. They also, just I think today or yesterday, approved a bill criminalizing denial of Israel's version, the government's version of events of October 7th. So those who challenge the government lie or line could face 5 years in prison. And, you know, the reason I think this is really telling is it's mirrored in the U.S. with what Trump is doing.
Blinken's farewell, you know, at the State Department, Sam Husseini, yeah. They never want to call on him. So he stood up and he tried to ask a question. They physically hauled him out. Hauled him out.
And Jim, I want to ask you about that, because you're more experienced in this arena than I am. When I watched that, and then it was hard enough to watch that and watch all the journalists who were just there sort of like pulling out their phones, you know, and filming it rather than, I don't know, at least speaking out is what I would have done had I been there. But my question to you is...
Spot a couple of times.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is my...
Well, one of them was back in 82, summer of 82, in the Electricidad du Liban building overlooking the beautiful port of Beirut, and Ariel Sharon came to pontificate and claim victory over all of Beirut. And we were there, many Israeli journalists and a spattering of American journalists and European journalists. And I stood up and asked the question. I said, Mr. Sharon, if you had to kill as many Israeli civilians as you did innocent Lebanese civilians in order to achieve this, would you have done it? And he went off and off and off. Eventually, I had to repeat the question three times. He never answered the question, but he did send armed guards, and they took me out of the, escorted me out of the press conference. He canceled the press conference and then held another one hours later, only inviting the Israeli media. But in the U.S., again and again, you see it, where journalists, they're afraid for their jobs.
Yeah.
And they just don't want to be associated. You can see them cringe. I'm not with him. I'm not with him. That happened to me in Baghdad, where I got called up by the Iraqis. And everybody, I mean, it's like nobody knew my name. Everybody just got away from me.
Yeah.
That's what Sam went through.
No, and you know, it was bad enough to happen to someone like you back then, but we're living in a very different time in the U.S. We're living in a time where, you know, the democracy that is at least revered or that is celebrated or that is espoused is slipping away much faster than many of us would want to admit. You know, there's many reasons for that, and I don't want to get too sidetracked, but Citizens United, the fact that now, you know, money is speech and, like, you know, a super PAC is considered a person. I mean, in my mind, what you said and what happened to Sam was bad enough. But then to watch CNN and others, mainstream media channels in the U.S., lie blatantly by saying protesters disrupt Blinken's final presser. Sam Hussein is not a protester. They know he's not a protester. He's a veteran journalist. He's accredited. He's been there for, you know, decades. And yet, why would they do that? You know, why just like glaze over it as protesters? You know, when these headlines that we constantly point out are missing Israel, the perpetrator, when it's Sky News or The Guardian or, you know, legitimately good, generally reporters exist at all these publications, but there is a clear and deliberate effort to erase any culpability for Israel. Because, you know, most people don't read these stories. So when they just glance, and maybe they didn't see the video on X because they're not paying attention of Sam Husseini, as you say, getting dragged out, they're just going to see, oh, protesters again, those Gaza protesters are disrupting. As if it's just like, you know, and to me, without a fourth estate, without a functioning fourth estate, without journalists, without media that are willing, we're not asking for them to do some heroic act. We're asking for them to do their fundamental core jobs. I mean, that's why I went into journalism. That's why I studied journalism at Columbia, even though, as you and I know, in order to be a good journalist, you don't have to study or go to grad school or what have you. But I have become so disillusioned. And this brings me back to your point when you were saying, you asked that question about to Sharon, I think, how many, you know, Israeli civilians would they have killed, or if they had killed this many? I mean, again, why would Israel be passing this bill criminalizing denial of Israel's version of October 7th? I mean, thanks to brave reporting from independent media in the West and some Israeli journalists, we know that Israel implemented the Hannibal Directive. We know that Israeli helicopter gunships unloaded their bullets and rockets on anything that moved. That was the order. We know that this was a mass application of a directive that's been around for a long time to prevent Israelis being taken hostage by Hamas. This was maybe the ultimate...
Matter of fact, subsequently, they very hurriedly buried all the bodies and said it would be a disgrace or immoral for us to do a forensic analysis of how these people died. It was very obvious from looking at some of the carnage of October 7th. That wasn't done by small arms walking out of Gaza. That took a helicopter gunship.
And no, I mean, yeah. I mean,
so,
their version is that a militia.
Yeah. They're trying to avoid them. And that's why so many journalists lost their lives. And, you know, it's also when you look at the whole thing that you're describing, I think is discouraging young people from becoming journalists, because
I agree.
They don't see the honor in that. They don't see, you know, obviously the United States and its standing for human rights around the world has been completely battered by the Biden administration. And now along comes Trump, and it appears to be only getting worse. I mean, It's, you know, people say they expect it, but, you know, they don't really want it.
No, I agree with you. And, you know, censorship, as you know, Jim, in the U.S. is accelerating. And the House last year, just for, you know, your audience who may not maybe care about these things or pay too much attention, but what I was referencing earlier in terms of the U.S. echoing this, you know, this crackdown on free speech, both in Israel and the U.S., the House expanded the definition of anti-Semitism, right, to prohibit it as hate speech. And I don't know, when I see my alma mater, Columbia, doing the same, when I see Harvard just today doing the same, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, imagine criticizing the Israeli government, their policies, such as the policies that were unleashed in Gaza the last 15 months, can now get you punished, like sanctioned at Harvard University. And it's because they adopted an expansive version of, you know, this viewpoint discriminatory IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, one that clearly makes belief in Zionism a protected status. Zionism is a political ideology, let alone a very violent, oppressive, supremacist one. So in my humble opinion, to your point, Biden spent 16 months, I think, destroying not only his own legacy, but as you say, you know, endangering, you know, American democracy. And it's not as if Trump is going to steer us the other direction, as you're saying. So, you know, I don't know. It's a bit of a twilight zone. Like, sometimes I'm kind of at a loss. Like, we're really willing, you know, to sort of sacrifice and jeopardize this experiment, right, in democracy that it's often referred to on the campaign trail, America, this sort of beacon of hope as it's presented. I can tell you, Jim, I've been around the world, I've lived in many countries, I'm sure you can relate to this. Any veneer that America was this liberal bastion that really believes in human rights and, you know, whatever happened in Iraq under false and fabricated pretenses, you know, whatever damage they've done in the world, that ultimately this narrative that has existed, right, and that all these NGOs and NDI and all these, you know, all these efforts, well-funded, well-coordinated efforts to present America as a bastion of liberalism and democracy that's trying to, like, you know, a beacon of light. I don't know anyone with the ability to think critically and who pays attention to the news that buys into that. And I don't know.
I think it's gone down quite a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just with the whole experience of Gaza, steamrolling UNRWA, and what has happened to the Palestinians. As you say, it has been the language. They're snakes. They are animals. The children need to die. The testimony of doctors that, you know, these infants were shot dead in the heart by a sniper. That wasn't an accident. You know,
yeah,
it's been going on. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, those testimonies, as much as they might go viral in a moment, like, you know how it is, like, with time, they are going to accumulate and accumulate and accumulate, as they already have started to do so now that there's been this so-called temporary ceasefire. And to your point, I mean, I don't know how that gets translated into anything other than contributing towards those who want America's demise, whether people inside or outside. And I don't say that happily. I say that regretfully. But to your point, yeah, I think it's how many doctors from how many different countries, you know, do you need to say infants were being shot, as you said, in the heart and the chest multiple times. I mean, toddlers are not shot by accident in the heart. I mean, one doctor saying he couldn't even put his stethoscope over the, you know, he couldn't find the heart. Like, these atrocities and the way in which these testimonies are distracted away. They distract away from it. And then the Western media's narrative becomes, no, This is not about genocide. This is not about shooting children. This is not about bombing hospitals. This is about self-defense. This is about, it's become almost, and I hate to use this word, it would be laughable were it not so sobering and dangerous. Just the way in which we've seen the media fail to do its job, and instead, whether willingly or not, whether knowingly or not, and I would argue, yes, knowingly and willingly, has instead chosen to peddle propaganda.
The whole point of the genocide charges, the crimes that have been taken to the ICC, all of this has been about accountability. But, you know, the Israeli public themselves, who have been immersed for more than a year in the story of the hostages, and that's an important part of it, they're human beings. Yeah. And
of course,
nobody disagrees with that. But what has come about, I'm afraid, is that it's all going to be forgotten. They're confident that, don't worry, this is all going to go away. International community never does anything about it. Impunity is written into the history of the Israeli-Palestinian dispute, the impunity for one side.
True.
I want to bring this to a close, but in, you know, there's got to be some reason to hope, or is there? You're totally dependent on the international community, and they're not stepping up.
Yeah. You know, I've spoken to Francesca about this when I've felt the most despair, and I asked her to kind of give me hope, at least that these mechanisms, these legal mechanisms and systems can be leveraged if there is courage to do so. And she does that job well. And the reason I reference her is because she reminds me, despair, Jim, as you know, is the oppressor's greatest weapon. Apathy is the product of prolonged despair. And I think that that is by design, right? They want to paralyze us, as you say. They want us, as you said earlier in this conversation, to believe resistance is futile, that injustice is inevitable for Palestinians. I would argue history proves otherwise. Maybe not always, but enough times. And that's why when I see people taking matters into their own hands in the UK, groups like Palestine Action shutting down Elbit Systems, Israel's largest arms manufacturer, when I see organizations that have only been around now for 5-6 months, like the Hind Rejab Foundation, leveraging international law and social media to document and challenge that impunity by compiling evidence of Israeli soldiers committing war crimes and publishing it themselves. When I see them turn acts of cruelty into tools for justice, it gives me a shred of hope, because it might seem lofty to say this, but I truly believe, not just as a Palestinian or as a journalist, but as a human being, I truly believe that the fight for Palestine is really not just a Palestinian fight. It has become so much more in these last 15 months. It's a fight not just for those of us who believe in justice, equality, and dignity, but it's really a true test of our times. With all that's going on with AI and all these concerns about automation, and, you know, the true test of justice lies not in if a ceasefire is upheld, but in whether we actually take advantage of the ceasefire to start holding those accountable for these crimes. And as you know, Palestinians, Palestinian families for decades have endured obscene levels of violence. Our stories have been buried under the weight of silence and complicity from the political and media establishment. But I do have faith, even if today I saw that, you know, after banning TikTok in the US and then quickly Trump bringing it back again, tactical, calculated move for his political reputation and benefit. Now on TikTok, apparently, the term Free Palestine, TikTok, the very platform that for so many months was documenting so much that it led people in the US and Congress and many others to demand that it be banned. Now, if you say Free Palestine on TikTok, it's banned. It doesn't actually even post in the comments. So all I'm trying to say is any lasting peace is going to require some very fundamental things. And until we get to a point where we're willing to acknowledge that, let alone start that, which is dismantling the structures of occupation and apartheid that have enabled the cycle of violence. Until then, I think the only thing we can do, and that's why I'm very grateful to have joined you today, is to amplify the voices of not only Gaza survivors or Palestinians, and also those who believe in justice and dignity and advocate for it and work towards it and are mobilized, because our despair is real, but for me, so is my hope. Justice is not something that has ever been granted to any group or individual. It is something you must demand, for better or worse. And justice, as you know, Jim, starts with the truth.
Ahmed Shihab El-Din, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to join us for the brief. Not altogether optimistic at the same time. A determined voice that's looking for justice and peace for everybody, not just for Palestinians, for everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. Please explore many of our other episodes of The Brief Podcast. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Give us a like or subscribe. For a complete listing, you can find more information at thebriefpodcast.org. For now, I'm Jim Clancy, and you've been briefed.